Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I just spoke with Sally Smith Hughes about her recent book, Genentech, The Beginnings of Biotech, that came out in 2011 with the University of Chicago Press. Now, this is a book that's very readable. It's got a very exciting and very engaging narrative, very compelling characters. It's a book that is going to be of obvious interest to anybody who enjoys reading about, either professionally or as an avocation, the history of modern biosciences, the modern life sciences and biotech in particular. But it's also got a lot to offer in terms of something that's not obvious from the title, and that is the craft of and the narrative possibilities of oral history. Hughes is very involved in a large oral history project, and those kinds of research methodologies very much shaped the way the book unfolds. They shaped the kind of story that emerges in a really interesting way. Now, this is a book that demonstrates, I think, very compellingly that the enormous success of Genentech was neither straightforward nor inevitable. In fact, the story was racked with problems, and it's very much a narrative about contingencies, human contingencies, political contingencies, economic contingencies, scientific contingencies, and so on and so forth. It's a story of a handful of people who figured out how to develop recombinant DNA technology, how to use it as an industrial process, how to build a business on it, and then how to make a profit from it. It's also the story about the emergence of a new kind of organism, really, that is the entrepreneurial biologist. It's a very compelling narrative. I had a great time talking with Sally about it, and I hope you enjoy.
Hello, Carla. How are you?
I'm excellent. And we are together here today at New Books in Science, Technology, and Society to talk with each other. So I'm here talking with Sally Smith Hughes about her recent book, Genentech, The Beginnings of Biotech. Thank you so much. Welcome to the podcast, Sally. And thanks for making time to speak with me today.
Well, I'm pleased to be given the opportunity.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, this is a book that was particularly exciting to me. It's not simply a biography of a very important and crucial company in the history of science, although it does that kind of work, but it's also a significant contribution to the fields of legal history, in a way, to the history of biotech, to the history of also the growing and evolving relationships between academia and industry in the history of the modern sciences, which incorporates really interesting transformations in some basic components of academic and intellectual work, as well as industrial work, including how we think about authorship, how we think about credit, how we think about intellectual property. So it's a very exciting book. It's extraordinarily clearly and elegantly written, and it really was a pleasure for me to read. So thank you, Sally.
Oh, you're very welcome.
My pleasure. So could you start us off, as is traditional for our podcast, by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to the field of the history of science, and in particular, the history of the modern life sciences?
Well, my dissertation at the University of London was on the life sciences, specifically on the very early history of the rise of virology, the identification of the virus as distinct from the bacterium. And once I graduated, I returned with my new husband to the United States, and of course, immediately began to look for colleagues in the history of science. We landed in North Carolina. My husband was teaching at the University of North Carolina. And I essentially was raising three children, but taking courses at Duke and UNC, or actually not so much taking, but sitting in on courses in that field, very kindly permitted to do so by two professors at each university. And turning my dissertation into my first book, which was on the concept of the virus. And after a number of years in UNC, we returned to the West Coast, where I had originated. And by then, much as I loved my children, I was desperate to really get a firm hold professionally in the field, and ended up at the Bancroft Library, in which is the research library at the University of California, Berkeley, in what had to be a very flexible position. This is very much a woman's story, because my children were still very young, some of them not even in school yet. And so it was the part-timeness, as well as the intellectual stimulus that attracted me. And the job, was essentially to do oral history, following up on work that had been done at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory by John Halbrun and Roger Hahn. And they had gotten a grant from the NEH to do a follow-up on the biological application of the particles and radioisotopes that were being produced by Ernst Lawrence's cyclotron at a laboratory called Donner Laboratory. So that's how I cut my teeth on oral history. Before then, it was merely a word to me. And that was 1978, and if you had told me that 30-some years later I would still roughly be working in that same field, I would have been very surprised. And eventually the part-time position became a full-time position, but oral history very much, oral history and the research that went into it, because I should hasten to say that the way oral history was and is done at the Bancroft Library is a very research-heavy field. We don't just walk in to an interview and start recording. We do the research to make sure that the interview is in-depth, and very often multiple interviews and on related topics. Well, because of my background, in fairly recent science, although my dissertation was focused on the period at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, when obviously I wasn't doing very many interviews, it became focused on fairly recent biomedicine, but mainly in fact almost exclusively in academia. These were academic scientists in a variety of fields, but all some one way or another related to biomedicine. And then, much later in the game, after I'd done a number of projects, including one of my very favorites, which was on the history of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco, the very first years, which was a fascinating topic. I talked with the leading scientists and physicians and university nurses during the first 3 years when the virus was being identified and patients dying at a horrendous rate, because, of course, we didn't have any therapies at that time. That work I was doing under a joint project with UCSF. So sometime in the 1990s, I received an offer from the Department of History at UCSF to come over again on a joint appointment and interview some of their leading lights in molecular biology. And that, unbeknownst to me, was what got me on the track that eventually led to this book on Genentech. The first person that I interviewed was William Rutter, Bill Rutter, who was the chairman of the Department of Biochemistry at UCSF and given credit for moving the department and, in a sense, the whole university into the molecular field. And one of his colleagues was Herbert Boyer. So the second interview that I, or second interviews, these are all multiple interviews, was with Herb Boyer. And as I implied, I had not been working on in any topic that related to commercialization or the industrialization. And all of a sudden, there it was right in front of me. Because not only was Herb Boyer, this was probably mid-90s, so Genentech, which was founded in 1976, was approximately 20 years old, and the biotech industry was formed, and people knew about the subject. So I all of a sudden began to learn with great interest about what goes into taking a very basic scientific invention, namely in this case recombinant DNA, and turning it into, in a multiple-step process, into a commercial product, and obviously that involved forming a company. So maybe I should backtrack a little bit and tell you, you know, very briefly about the invention of recombinant DNA. It is, as many people know now, the invention of Herb Boyer, who at that point was an associate professor in the Department of Microbiology at UCSF, and Stanley Cohen, Stanley Norman Cohen, because there's another, believe it or not, scientist named Stanley Cohen. This is Stanley Norman Cohen, and he was a professor at, in the Department of Medicine at UCSF, who was, I mean, at Stanford, I'm sorry, who was working on plasmids. And the two men met at a conference in Hawaii in 1972, and telescoping a lot of preliminary science, began to talk and to figure out that their mutual interests, I mean, Stan's was in plasmids as a way of studying antibiotic resistance, and Herb's interest was in restriction enzymes, which are bacterial enzymes that splice DNA, in some cases at very specific junctures. So again, saying it very simply, they agreed to collaborate when they got home, and they did a set of three different experiments which showed that one could clip off selected pieces of DNA and introduce them into a bacterium using plasmids as the vehicle. And plasmids are circles of DNA that are separate from the main bacterial chromosome. And by the end of the third experiment, which was performed in 1973, they showed that higher organism DNA, in this case from the clawed frog called Xenopus, could indeed be spliced and successfully cloned, that is, reproduced in bacteria. And this was a surprising discovery, because it was very much felt that the mechanisms for reproducing bacteria and higher organism DNA were necessarily exclusive and distinct. And no one had had done anything like this before. Mm-hmm. What was immediately apparent to both Stan and Herb was that not only was this a boon for basic molecular biological research, and indeed within a few years molecular biology labs around the world were using their technique, but they also foresaw the industrial applications, that indeed if you could use this technique and actually express the clone genes, there were all kinds of possibilities. And because Herb and Stan were working in the biomedical field, they thought first and foremost of making specific drugs in bacteria, with the idea that the drugs could be made in great quantity by reproducing the relevant gene as the bacteria divided, and hopefully the drugs such as insulin and growth hormone would be cheaper than those already being manufactured by other means, non-bacterial means, by the pharmaceutical industry.
Now, thank you. Maybe I'll just jump in here just to let listeners know. Now, Boyer and Cohen, or Herb Boyer and Stan Cohen, as you're mentioning, they may sound like sort of names right now, but the first chapter does this really wonderful job in really introducing and elaborating their characters. I think you mentioned here that one reporter calls Boyer, who's actually quite different from Cohen in temperament and the way he looks, a Baroque angel in blue jeans, right? He's got Siamese cats named Watson and Crick. He's just a really, really interesting, and it seems to me as a reader, very exuberant personality, versus Stan Cohen, who, although he played the banjo, so it was sort of interesting, you describe him as trim, bearded, balding, and bespectacled, just very, very different temperaments. And the first chapter, I think, does a really wonderful job introducing them as people, right, as human beings, so that this really gives a lot of texture to the story of what happens afterwards. Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about before we kind of move on from Boyer and Cohen's research on recombinant DNA and plasmids and the way that gets taken up by, as other characters enter the story and this company gets created, I wanted to ask you a little bit about something that you mentioned very early on in our conversation, and that is the oral history project, the sort of the oral history component of the research methodology that went into the book. Now, I had the pleasure of going to the website that you mentioned in the beginning of the book that archives these oral histories, these interviews with many, many figures that show up in the book and many beyond. And it's a really amazing, incredible resource for anybody interested in the history of the modern sciences. Now, this is a very particular kind of research methodology, and I'd love to hear a little bit about how the particular demands and rhythms and nature of oral history and of that kind of research shaped your project. What were these interviews like, and how did that kind of resource to help shape the book as you wrote it, the way you decided to structure the book and structure the narrative and tell the story?
Well, simply speaking, it was the fact that I had this wonderful and, you know, pretty unique collection of oral histories, not only with the prime movers and shakers, namely Boyer and Cohen and later Swanson, but other people who directly impinged on the rise of modern molecular biology and its segue into biotech. When I say that, I'm thinking of Arthur Kornberg and Paul Berg at Stanford, and Bill Rutter at UCSF, who went on to form Chiron Corporation. And so the oral histories were definitely the inspiration, but I knew all along that the oral histories alone would not be sufficient. They, of course, give an immediacy because people are talking. They almost inevitably begin to relive the history that we're talking about. And, of course, the personality shine through. And one of my motives in writing this book was to dispel the commonly held idea by sort of the woman in the street that scientists tend to be colorless, nose to the ground, unapproachable people. Well, my experience is that they are anything but. They're as human as the rest of us. They have their ups and their downs. Their personalities often have, or I could say almost inevitably, have an impact on the decisions they make about the direction of their research. And I wanted the personality part of this complicated story to shine out. And that was where the oral histories came in, as well as providing a lot of information that would be difficult or impossible to find in other sources. And the way I have always done oral history is to try to read as much as time allows. And of course, then there is the wonderful privilege of literally sitting at the knee of people who have actually done this work. And as a series of interviews on a given topic, say molecular biology, goes on, of course, there's a tremendous learning curve. So in no way did I ever become close to having the expertise that my subjects did. It was inevitable that I learned quite a bit about not only the science, but about the external factors that are so prevalent in this story, which is another reason that I was so intrigued by this process of commercializing a basic science. It may be time to go into the context in which this was done. Although perhaps we should first get Genentech founded.
let's found Genentech. So as we move from the story, and I think as a reader, the sense that comes out of the nature of the oral history sources, as you've described them, of reliving the history, is very present in the narrative of the book itself. And it's really, really interesting and kind of wonderfully evocative in that way. So the next stage in this history, as we move into chapter 2, where we come upon the creation of Genentech, involves the entry into the story of another character, and that is Robert Swanson. So you've briefly mentioned him earlier, but can you introduce Robert Swanson for us and maybe say a little bit about the role that he played in working with Boyer and ultimately creating Genentech?
Yes. Well, Bob Swanson was an only child of working class people who obviously was very bright and was admitted to MIT with the idea of going into chemistry. He was a chemistry major. a summer job at a chemical company dissuaded him of the idea that he wanted to spend his professional life working for a chemical company. So using a lot of his entrepreneurialism, you could always already, I believe, see it when he was still an undergraduate, but he persuaded the powers that be at the Sloan, at MIT Sloan School of Management, to allow him to finish up his chemistry degree and at the same time enter the first year of business school, which he did. And making a complicated story short again, he became particularly interested in a course on entrepreneurship. And when he graduated, having and he has a degree in both chemistry and in business, he became an employee, a young employee of Citibank, where he and some of his young colleagues were given the opportunity to invest a hunk of money in what essentially was risk investment. Did very well, and within a few years was sent to the West Coast with a colleague to open up a branch of Citibank in the San Francisco Bay Area. Because by then, and this was early 70s, what was to become Silicon Valley did not yet have that name, was obviously, to anyone paying attention, a nexus for high tech, particularly in the electronics and computers field. So Citibank was hoping to capitalize on investing in some of the new startups that were coming along. So Swanson became more and more engaged, and at the same time somewhat dissatisfied that he was, an advisor and investor in these new startups. But what he decided he really wanted was to start his own company. As the denouement after he left Citicorp and had been Citibank and had done a few other things, he joined what became the iconic venture capital firm of Kleiner Perkins. And in those days, it was just Kleiner Perkins and a junior partner. Within a few years, it became Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, which anybody in the venture capital field knows is one of the major venture capital firms in the world. Anyway, Swanson worked there for a little bit more than a year, and one of the investments that he was to oversee was with a new company called Cetus Corporation, which was founded in 1971 in Emeryville, California, across the bay from San Francisco. And Cetus wasn't, in Kleiner and Perkins' eyes, doing very well. They had a very broad agenda, which really at that point had nothing to do with recombinant DNA. It was trying to capitalize on an invention by the Nobel laureate, Donald Glaser, which was an automated way of picking out bacteria that were more productive of antibiotics. But in Kleiner and Perkins' eyes, the company was not sufficiently focused. So Swanson attempted to persuade the two co-founders of Cetus, Ronald Cape and Peter Farley, to take up recombinant DNA. But as Kate later said in a long series of interviews with me, he was leery about what was happening in the wider society, which we have yet in this interview, in our interview, Carla, to mention, which is the recombinant DNA controversy. Almost immediately after Cohen and Boyer had invented recombinant DNA and the scientific world became aware of its potential, simultaneously, people in both the scientific world and in the general public began to be concerned about the possible dangers of the technology. I mean, if you could manipulate bacteria, you could maybe produce organisms that were harmful to the health and safety of the public. So within 2 years of the publication in 1973 of the seminal work of Cohen and Boyer, the scientific community under the leadership of leading scientists such as Paul Berg and Baltimore organized the recombinant DNA conference at Asilomar in California with the hope of setting up federal guidelines for recombinant DNA research, with the idea that under the guidelines the research could go forward. So this controversy, indeed the government did set up what were then called the NIH guidelines for recombinant DNA research, which were published at the end of 1976 and required all laboratories working with certain kinds of organisms that were thought to be potentially dangerous to abide by the guidelines, which they're very complicated, and there were many layers of regulations in the beginning, but they did such things as telling you which kinds of organisms you could use and which not, and what kind of laboratory conditions the research could go forward, and so on. So this political controversy, political and social controversy, was going on at the very time that Cetus and eventually Genentech were trying to get off the ground. And Ron Cape, in particular, the co-founder of Cetus, was leery of getting involved in a science which had so many political concerns associated with it. Plus, and equally important, if not more so, it wasn't at all clear at that time that recombinant DNA really could carry through and make products that could be eventually marketed and made profitable. So getting back to Swanson, that was sort of the background why he was not successful in persuading Cape to take on recombinant DNA at that time. So there he was, and Kleiner and Perkins were beginning to be leery about this junior partner, Swanson, who didn't seem to be able to carry off his almost, in retrospect, impossible assignment, and he was let go. So that at some point in the mid-70s, he was without a job, he was living on Social Security, and he was madly interviewing with all kinds of Silicon Valley companies, but not happy with the opportunities. As he made some sort of a comment, I can't remember it exactly, that his aim was not to join a company and make tennis shoes. So he began to read because of the publicity that was even in standard newspapers about the looming recombinant DNA controversy, about this new technology. And he became fascinated and thought that indeed it had commercial potential. So he took the initiative and began to call up the leading scientists, and apparently he got the names from the publicity that had surrounded the Asilomar conference. He called, it's not clear in what order he called people, but he eventually and very early on ended up calling Herb Boyer. Now, Herb, as I mentioned at the very beginning, and Stan had seen the potential commercial applications of recombinant DNA. But being academics and also because of their respective personalities, had not done anything about it. Well, that's not quite true. Boyer had made a stab. He had gone so far as to ask a scientist in Germany to synthesize a gene, a small gene, that he was then going to try in his laboratory at UCSF to clone and see if he could express it as a protein. Mm-hmm. Well, the German scientist, for whatever reason, failed to come up with a DNA segment, the synthetic DNA. This is DNA that is totally constructed by chemical means in a test tube. And so Boyer went back to his work in the laboratory, which in itself was totally preoccupying, because he was his laboratory was one of the sources, was one of the only sources in the early days where you could get the E. coli bacteria and the plasmids that were necessary to perform recombinant DNA technology. So now, flashing a year or so ahead, out of the blue, Boyer received a phone call from this unknown young man named Bob Swanson. And Boyer, who was very busy, was finally persuaded to see this young man, who said he thought he could, that a company could be founded on the basis of recombinant DNA. Well, Boyer kind of poo-pooed it. He said, all right, I'll give you a few minutes on a Friday afternoon. And in the back of his mind all along was, well, I'll see this young man, but I'll try to get rid of him as fast as possible. So Boyer arrived and created quite a stir, because he was dressed in a three-piece suit. He looked very much like an alien to the very casually dressed scientists. And he appeared in Boyer's laboratory, and the two talked. And gradually, as Swanson talked, he persuaded Boyer that he knew about forming companies, that he knew about raising capital, that that's what he had been doing for the last few years. And then Boyer became more and more intrigued. They adjourned to a nearby tavern, and what had been in Boyer's mind a very brief meeting turned out to be 3 hours worth. And the upshot of it was that they agreed to form a partnership to investigate the possibilities of recombinant DNA through experimentation. And Boyer gave Swanson the assignment to figure out which gene, which eventual hoped-for product they should go for. So that was the very start of their collaboration. Boyer pretty much went back to his academic position. He never intended to give up his position at UCSF, and Swanson was left with the task of raising the capital and, you know, beginning in finding a laboratory space. Boyer had scientists in mind. There were people in his own laboratory. Mm-hmm. In terms of the capitalization, Swanson went back to his old bosses, Kleiner and Perkins, and with considerable effort persuaded them that recombinant DNA could be a going thing. And the upshot of that was, I think, $200,000, as I remember, mm-hmm. of startup money.
Well, Sally, if I can sort of jump in here, because one of the things that you're raising here is a theme that goes on to become crucial in all of the chapters in the book. Now, we won't have time in our remaining time to, you know, to go through all of the elements of the narrative as it unfolds, but certainly one of the things that's crucial in every single one of these chapters is a point that builds on this collaboration you're describing between Swanson and Boyer and the nature of their respective contributions, and that is the sort of understanding Genentech, as you describe it in a later chapter, as a kind of recombinant culture of a hybrid of academic values and commercial objectives. And certainly, as we move through the book, move through especially chapter 3, one of the things that we see is that the people coming into this story, so the other characters, the other scientists who are brought into this, and other companies and representatives of companies who are brought into this collective to do this work, are having to negotiate the different demands and the different kinds of both personal, epistemic, and sort of economic interests of these two realms that they're straddling in this company, the academic and the sort of the privately funded corporate research world. Now, this creates tensions on many levels, and one of the things that happens later on in this story revolves around sort of what happens with the products that come out of Genentech, out of this company. Because, in fact, as you're mentioning, this is a commercial company, but it's also a company that is devoted to creating products that come from basic science, right? So this is something that I'd actually love for you to talk a little bit about. In particular, as Genentech, and certainly in the next chapter and the chapter after, is starting to prove itself by developing these new technologies that are based on the synthesis of first somatostatin, a kind of hormone, then insulin, and we'd look at human growth hormone, issues of authorship and credit emerge. Life scientists at this time, as you're telling us, and life scientists made up the bulk of the scientists working for Genentech, are working in an academic culture that really didn't emphasize patents and intellectual property protection. And at the same time, the kind of negotiation of credit and authorship on a patent was very different from what they were used to in negotiating credit for scientific publications. So can you talk for a little bit about that that tension as it shapes this story, especially because this is something that seems to be a recurring theme and a very important point that recurs throughout the chapters of the book and the stages of this narrative?
Well, intellectual property, of course, is basic to the success of Genentech and arguably any startup company. And it was a foreign field to almost all academic scientists, including Boyer. You know, Swanson, of course, had to be up to date with the importance of intellectual patent in property and in as manifested in patents. And one of the first things that he did, and this is another strand that needs to be woven into this story, is that Stanford and UC, at the time that Genentech was getting off the ground, were in a furious set of negotiations with the federal government and with their own scientists about patent, taking out a patent on recombinant DNA procedure. And that whole effort was extremely controversial, first of all, because opponents saw recombinant DNA as a product of basic federally supported science. And here were two universities trying to privatize and profit from basic science. And then it ran up against what we've already talked about, the recombinant DNA controversy. Here were scientists, trying to expand the breadth of recombinant DNA into the industry field where there was even less oversight. So it was a very controversial thing to be doing, and one of Swanson's first activities was to go over to Stanford and talk to the very enterprising head of Stanford's Office of Technology Licensing and try to get an exclusive license on using the patent for the production of pharmaceuticals in bacteria. And Niels Reimers, his name is, refused. They had not yet gotten the patent. They hadn't figured out the licensing arrangement. He and his superiors at Stanford were very aware of having to tiptoe through this minefield of the political controversy and at the same time try to benefit from what was increasingly prophesied to be a very lucrative patent. They were certainly right about that. I think it's been surpassed now, but the recombinant DNA patent, which Stanford and UC eventually won in 1980, became for a time the most lucrative patent in the country. So there was that tension too, but in terms of Genentech's own work, Swanson knew that patenting was going to be a huge part of it, not only to protect from infringement, but also for a young company to have a portfolio of patents is another selling point. So as soon as the research began, Swanson began to look around for a patent attorney and hired Tom Kiley, who became a very aggressive pursuer of patents for Genentech. But you're absolutely right that intellectual property is one of the cornerstones still. It still very much is, and of course causes practically ceaseless litigation, including at Genentech. I touch on the future litigation that arises from both the insulin and the growth hormone work, but it's such a huge subject and a very rich area for further work. But it's very interesting to me anyway that it was this very fundamental early work of Genentech that gave rise to such incredible patent battles beginning as early as the late 1980s and well into the 90s.
And the book even in the last chapter before the epilogue, you mentioned this landmark case for historians of science, certainly who are interested in the relationship between modern science and industry and the law, of the Diamond versus Chakrabarty case, right, about the sort of, which hinges on the issue of whether a living being can be patented and sort of ultimately is resolved by the Supreme Court, who argues that anything under the sun made by man is patentable subject matter. So this is a story with very important ramifications, and the ramifications that I think were still, even after Genentech has now been sold to another company, dealing with. Now, as the story unfolds and the Genentech has a series of successes with increasingly more difficult objects or increasingly more difficult materials in an increasingly competitive environment, we come to this the case, which is chapter five, which is sort of the chapter five is centered on, which is the case of human growth hormone. This is an attractive goal for many reasons for Genentech, and it brings out also an issue here that you touched on when really describing your own trajectory in this field on some level, but it's also something that emerges implicitly, but here really explicitly in the nature of this story, and that is the importance of a kind of gendered element to this story. You mentioned very explicitly that these were all men who were talking about, and this was a very masculine culture at Genentech. In fact, I think you mentioned somebody referred to it as Macho City. How, I mean, this seems to be an important contribution, certainly for people interested in issues of gender and science. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of this story and its importance to the way you see this narrative and the book developing?
Well, it was men. I think the first there are female lab techs that come in pretty early in the game, but my memory is the first female scientists don't come to Genentech until the very late 70s. And remember, this is it's not only a man's game, but it's a young man's game. And we're talking about the 70s when some of the sensibilities that we have now were only beginning to appear. And it was a rough and ready, very intense, very masculine, very competitive, because what we haven't brought in to this story is the fact that there were races going on with academic scientists at Harvard and at UCSF who were going after the same genes. And it seems to me a very, the culture that was beginning to form and the very circumstance of this very young company with its very young and almost exclusively male protagonists manifested a very male and aggressive and not particularly welcoming culture for women. And, you know, some of the early women scientists talk about that. You know, I think I quote from Jane Gitcher in the book, and there are also there's an interview with the one and only woman scientist that I interviewed at Genentech, and that certainly was not deliberate on my part to limit the interviews to only one woman. It was simply the fact that since I was focused on the very early years of Genentech, there just weren't women scientists. So, you know, I think all that has very much changed as Genentech has evolved and, you know, evolved, and the times have changed now. It would not be acceptable to have the culture at Genentech. But, you know, it's kind of a catch-22, though, because some of Genentech's early success is doubtless due to this very intense work ethic and, you know, the aggressiveness with which they pursued their goals. So it'd be interesting to think about if Genentech had been formed 20 years later, what the culture would have been, and would it have led to the immediate cloning successes, because it was, you know, every year in those first years, beginning with the cloning of somatostatin, and then insulin, and then the growth hormone, they had a spectacular success one year after another.
And in fact, one of the really interesting things about this story is that as you're talking about characters who are getting involved in this company, who have a choice, right? They're often deciding to leave some kind of an academic position in order to take up a position at this company that, you know, we may not understand this from our position now, but your book shows very elegantly was very much not proven. It was very much a risk. And one of the things that you show here is that more and more, as the time goes on, these very talented academics are drawn into Genentech, this sort of unproven, very risky venture, over and over again, citing, if I'm remembering correctly, the attraction of the science itself, this sort of opportunity to work intensively on the science without distractions, without having to work or to worry constantly about funding. Whereas at the same time, you're talking about people who seem to be giving really all of themselves to this work. As you're mentioning, they're competing for funding with other teams, with other labs. They're often giving up their personal lives or home lives in order to do this, working around the clock. And this creates a kind of culture that's really interesting actually here to read about.
Well, it took over their lives. Mm-hmm. I think first the attraction was the science itself. Those that had been doing it in academic labs were very quickly moved to Genentech, were totally enraptured with the idea of the science itself and the added possibility that it could be made practical and useful to society. That indeed was a theme that had been running through molecular biology in particular. A person as eminent as Watson had written about how molecular biology needed to show that it was not just an academic enterprise, that it could lead to practical benefits for society. And indeed, that is one of the tenets of NIH funding, that yes, you do basic science, but the eventual hope is that it will have practical implications for society. So when recombinant DNA came along, you know, many of the scientists, you know, sighed a sigh of relief and said, well, at last we've got something that has real commercial potential, where there had been very little of that in biology itself before then. Mm-hmm. So that was very much a magnet for many of the scientists. And remember, they were young, too. You know, they told me that, yes, it was a science, but they, many of them didn't have families yet. It was some of them came with the idea, well, I'll try this. If it doesn't work out, I'll go back to academia and, or I'll try something new. But it was the science, almost to a man, and I say that because they were men, mm-hmm. exclusively, that drew them to Genentech.
Well, Sally, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I just want to mention for listeners, although I won't, in order to respect your time, I won't ask you to talk in detail about this, but I'll mention that the book closes with the chapter that sees us through not only a shift in the broader cultural and national environment away from these early concerns with the consequences and ethics of recombinant DNA and toward an interest in exploiting these commercial and industrial opportunities that we've been talking about. And also, it takes us through the story of the ways that Genentech managed the initial public offering of the stock on Wall Street and ultimately resulted in the fastest, as you put in the book, first day gain in Wall Street history. So it's a very interesting closer of this story and leads us through all the way to very recently. So, Sally, there's a ton in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, and it's an extraordinarily rich narrative. There's a lot of really compelling characterizations, in addition to being, I think, a really fascinating example of the kinds of stories that you can tell using oral histories as a major and a very valuable resource. Is there anything in particular about the book or about the project more generally that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, especially perhaps listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Well, what one of my motivating forces in writing this book was to keep it simple and in the sense that you didn't have to have a technical background to read it. I feel very strongly that as our society becomes more and more science and tech-based, that there's a appalling gap between the woman in the street and what's happening in the scientific field. And of course, one book, and certainly not mine in particular, has any hope of, you know, closing that gap. I still felt strongly that by making, writing a book that featured people in, you know, doing exciting things, was possibly a draw to the general reader, and that I wanted to make the story exciting, and I've generally felt that it is exciting. I mean, as I tried to explain, I was drawn into this whole field kind of unwittingly, and it was really the excitement and the issues that, you know, commercializing a new science brought up that I thought was very intriguing and perhaps helpful in explaining at a introductory level what biotech is and what this industry that we that is so prominent in recent science today is all about. I mean, much, much more needs to be done. We need more people working on the basic science of that goes into biotech, but also in looking at the history of the new companies that are coming up, because I think an informed society is absolutely critical in the 21st century about what's happening, not just in biotech, of course, but that happens to be my field of interest. So much more, I think, could be said, but that certainly was a motive, and that's one reason that I kept it short, and I hope readers find it snappy.
Well, I certainly did. So at least one reader, you have evidence that it's very fluid, and I think the story is very exciting as well. So you certainly accomplished that. So now that this book is out, what's next for you? Is there a particular project or projects that are inspiring you right now?
Well, I'm because venture capital is such a large part of the financing of the biotech industry, I have been doing a series of interviews on venture capital, not necessarily exclusively on biotech, but for somebody who really, in the beginning, didn't have a financial bent at all. As I said, I came out of the history of recent biomedical science. I actually find this interface between the economic and financial background and the conduct of commercial science very intriguing, and the people who are pursuing it. So that's what I'm thinking about nowadays.
Well, Sally, thank you so much for making the time. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations on the book.
Well, I am very pleased to have had the time to talk about it, and I thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next time.